Okay, this is White Iron Resistance Network, the War Radio Network. This is another health show. This time of year we have the flu going around, so I wanted to cover that briefly. The stomach flu, it's already hit, it's already out. Flu shot may or may not protect you, but here's some good advice for prevention and helping to make it a little bit easier. As far as prevention, there's a very good recipe for a ginger juice drink. And it involves having the 3 to 4 tablespoons of ginger in a cup with the juice of 1 lemon and some honey, maybe a couple teaspoons or a tablespoon of honey. You make that up and you sip on that all day. And it probably won't last you all day because you need to have that cup again probably a couple more times throughout the day, but you just sip it. It's going to be really intense because there's a lot of ginger in 3 to 4 tablespoons of ginger juice. It's best to have fresh ginger and make ginger juice. You can do that by juicing it in a juicer. If you don't have a juicer, you can use a food processor and take 2 to 3 pounds of ginger and grate it, and then use a potato ricer. That's the one that has the small holes. And you then press that ginger in a bowl, and you can extract the juice from it. If you're really hard up and don't have any of that equipment, then you can just go buy some organic ginger juice, though that would probably be a lot more expensive that way. If you do that as a prevention, that will definitely help keep it away, because fresh ginger has antiviral activity against human respiratory virus in human respiratory tract cell lines. The study showed that fresh, not dried, ginger is effective against the HRSV-induced plaque formation on airway epithelium, and it blocks viral attachment and internalization. In short, ginger prevents the virus from attaching and staying attached to the respiratory tract. And if you already have stomach flu, or know someone who does, the symptoms are nausea, vomiting, stomach pain and cramps, diarrhea, fever, headache, and appetite loss. Usually, the protocol for a diet is the BRAT diet. And that's for bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast. And that's the treatment for diarrhea and nausea. And that was based on the premise that the best foods for an upset stomach are low in fat, are low in the fiber, insoluble fiber, are bland, they contain pectin, that's in the ripe fruits, the soluble fiber in ripe fruits, and that helps by reducing the fluid loss, and then the electrolytes, replace electrolytes. But if you're not eating grains, then the next diet with a strange name is called the Scabs diet. Soup and stew, coconut water, applesauce, bone broth, and bananas. The soup and stew would be at the end when you've regained your stomach, able to hold things in it. Our super stew would have a lot of vegetables and be very, very soft vegetables, so cook for a long period of time, and also the meat. Coconut water, that's nature's Gatorade, that has all the electrolytes. It's even been used intravenously in lieu of medical hydration fluid. Applesauce, it has the soluble fiber pectin, that's a probiotic for the gut. It helps balance your gut flora, which has been lost and wiped out from the stomach flu, and it helps reduce the fluid loss. Cooking them, apples, into applesauce, it'd be easier on your stomach than raw because fresh apples contain cellulose, and that's the fiber you don't want when you have the stomach flu. Bone broth, that has a lot of amino acids. It also has a lot of electrolytes. The amino acids that it has help to heal the stomach. And then bananas replace the electrolytes, potassium, which is lost, and bananas also contain resistant starch that helps your gut bacteria generate these acids, these fatty acids, and that stimulates fluid and electrolyte absorption. So bananas help a lot with hydration and keeping your electrolytes in balance. Don't want to jump immediately from the stomach flu with vomiting and diarrhea straight into solid foods. So you start off with the fluid replacement, that would be the coconut water, if that stays down. The broth. If those stay down, a little bit at a time, and then move up through the list of foods. So those are just some hints for things to do for this stomach flu that's going around. In conjunction, there may be some chest congestion, and the ginger, honey, lemon would be perfect for that to help break it up. You'd want to hit it at the earliest possible moment, so if you start feeling under the weather, get a sore throat, and it hasn't progressed beyond that, you can almost just kick it with that ginger juice concoction. Here's a clip of an interview by a Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. He's had over 30 years of research as an MD. In this interview, he discusses why there are different diets that people should be on and the type of person that you are. Actually, he could tell what type of diet you should be on, proving in his practice that everybody is very individual, and one type of diet is not going to be what everyone needs. And he also is the author of several books. One of them is What Went Wrong? The Truth Behind the Clinical Trial of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. It's a Silver Award winner by the Independent Book Publishers Association of 2013, the Ben Franklin Awards in the science category. The book is where Dr. Gonzalez chronicles the failure of the National Cancer Institute, the NIH-funded clinical trial conducted under the auspices of Columbia University, set up to test his nutritional treatment in patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. In this account, Dr. Gonzalez reveals how poor trial design and poor implementation at the highest levels of academic research world helped undermine this promising project. The book discusses in detail two official government investigations that have confirmed Dr. Gonzalez's allegations that the study was not properly supervised. Dr. Gonzalez also illustrates the biases within the scientific community that make fair testing of unconventional treatments so difficult. And this story paints a detailed picture of mismanagement of a promising clinical trial of pancreatic cancer therapy by vested interests of the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Health, and academia. He also wrote a book about One Man Alone, An Investigation of Nutrition, Cancer, and William Donald Kelly. In this book, Dr. Gonzalez describes his investigation of the nutritional enzyme cancer treatment developed by the alternative practitioner Dr. William Donald Kelly. In addition to a discussion of Kelly's treatment approach, the book includes 50 case histories of successfully treated cancer patients. He also wrote a book about the trophoblast and the origins of cancer, One Solution to the Medical Enigma of Our Times. In this book, Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Isaacs provide a comprehensive review of Dr. John Beard's 100-year-old theories about cancer from the perspective of contemporary molecular biology. The authors show how Dr. Beard most likely discovered stem cells and very well may have uncovered the root origins of cancer and its effective treatment with proteolytic enzymes. And the last book, The Enzyme Treatment of Cancer and Its Scientific Basis. Dr. John Beard's study of the mammalian placenta led him to the conclusion that in its early incarnation, this tissue behaves much as a cancerous tumor. He then proposed that pancreatic enzymes regulate placental development and in turn represent the body's main defense against cancer. In 1911, he published The Enzyme Treatment of Cancer to favorable reviews. Though in his lifetime, the scientific community never embraced his ideas about cancer, he died in relative obscurity in 1924. In recent years, evidence from molecular biology and stem cell research increasingly confirms many of Dr. Beard's fundamental precepts. So over 30 years of cancer research, we may have had a cure if they were only supported even a quarter of what they do for the drug companies. We probably could have cancer cured. But who wants cancer to be cured? Not the established medical system. So with that background of Dr. Gonzalez, please listen to this lecture. And this is just a small amount of his information that he has.
I'm very excited to welcome to the Evolution of Medicine Summit for the first time, Dr. Nicolas Gonzalez. He is a conventionally trained immunologist who now does advanced nutritional work for cancer and other degenerative diseases here in New York. And it's such a pleasure to have you here on the Evolution of Medicine Summit, Dr. Gonzalez.
Well, James, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to reach out to our colleagues. And in terms of the anthropology of nutrition, when one goes back and studies the work of Weston Price, for example, who traveled the world looking at traditional cultures that were living according to traditional agricultural and hunting practices, he found that humans adjusted to and thrived on a variety of diets. The diets ranged from the Eskimos, who lived on nothing but fatty red meat, 80% fat, 20% protein, to the tribes living in the Congo or the Amazon, was largely a plant-based diet. You go to the Maasai in Kenya, they lived on a gallon of raw milk a day. Colin Campbell has made a career of attacking milk as the enemy of civilized man. However, you get the Maasai, who lived on a gallon of raw milk a day, raw, not pasteurized, and blood, no fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains, and they were among the healthiest people ever studied. George Mann at Vanderbilt University during the 70s and 80s studied the traditional Maasai, and even though they ate 70% of their calories as saturated fat, were extremely healthy, no heart disease, no cancer, no diabetes, no arthritis, even in the oldest Maasai. The point of that is different groups adapted to, adjusted to, and thrived on completely different diets. The Eskimos never ate milk. The Maasai, of course, never ate seal blubber. So different people adjusted to, thrived on different diets. And the idea that we can force humans today, particularly in America, which is a melting pot, to fit into one dietary category, it doesn't make scientific or rational sense. So we approached each patient individually. We have no preconceived notions. Every patient that comes into our office gets tested. We determine what diet they need. And even with the dozens of variations of the 10 basic diets, we'll individualize it to the patient's needs according to whatever allergies they may have or proclivities. But everything's very individualized. There isn't one diet for everybody. One of the problems we face with the traditional nutritional teaching is that you have proponents and experts that will promote one diet. Like Pritikin and Ornas believe everybody should be on a vegetarian diet. And the Pritikin diet was 75% carbohydrates, about 15% protein, all from plant sources, and less than 10% fat, again, all from plant sources. And Pritikin and his successor, Ornish, believes all humans, whatever their size, shape, form, genetics, geographic origins of their ancestors, should follow a purely vegetarian, plant-based diet. Then you get Bob Atkins, whom I knew very well, who practiced here in New York for years. He was famous as the ketogenic diet doctor. He put all his patients on a high-fat diet, and he had patients that didn't do well. I knew him very well, and he would insist they just weren't compliant. And I would talk to him and said, Bob, these are patients that need to be on plant food. He would never acknowledge that. Then you get someone like Gerald Reven out at Stanford, who is a proponent of the Mediterranean-type diet, where he thinks all humans, again, whatever their size, shape, form, genetics, geographic origins of their ancestors, cultural beliefs, should be on a balanced diet. With his diet's about 40% calories from fat, 45% from carbohydrates, and about 15% protein, and both plant and animal sources, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, whole grains, fish, poultry, some red meat, good quality fat. So you have these three trends in nutrition, both in conventional alternative nutrition. The vegetarian proponents were very fanatical about their beliefs that all humans should be on a vegetarian diet. The people who follow Atkins and the current ketogenic diet promoters, I think everyone should be on a high-fat diet. Then Reven and the Mediterranean followers, they say everyone should be on a balanced type diet, a Mediterranean diet. And they all have a piece of the truth, but what they do is they generalize from their particular experience where some people may have done well in their particular diet. I think all humans, would, again, whatever their background, should be on that diet. We approach it differently. We assume every patient that walks into our office needs a unique diet for their particular needs, and it may range from largely plant-based, like an Ornish diet, to a ketogenic-type Atkins diet, and everywhere in between.
That's so interesting. Do you feel like potentially the message of that doesn't travel as quickly or as fast because it's not it's not flashy and it's not one size fits all?
We've been approached by, it's interesting you should say that, we get approached by publishers routinely because I'm well known, I'm here in New York, and the publishing world is in New York, and they just can't conceive of how they could write a popular book where you use a variety of different diets, because it's not, as they use the term prescriptive, it's not prescriptive. They love books where one size fits all. And of course, a lot of the very successful nutritional books for the last few years always have the word power in it, power carbs, power protein, power fats. They're getting away from that. And every 6 months there's a new diet book that sells millions of copies and suggests one diet for everybody. Ornish's books sold millions, Atkins' books sold tens of millions, and Reven's book has sold well too. And they're all promoting completely different types of diet, insisting everyone should follow their particular diet. And you start reading this stuff, and all it does is lead to confusion. In fact, one of the things we've learned with a lot of lay people as well as professionals get interested in nutrition. They'll read Ornish and they think everyone should be vegetarian. They read Atkins and he makes a case everyone should be meat eater. They read Reavin, everyone should be on a Mediterranean diet. And they walk away with this really well-intentioned interest in nutrition, totally confused and unsure of what they should do, if they're practitioners, what they should do with their patients. So a lot of this conflicting information really is not helpful. And it could be easily resolved if the practitioners and the experts and the people who write these books realize different people need different diets. It's not a complicated concept. And it's not as if this is something we made up. If you read Weston Price, who published his book in 1939, the results of his seven-year study traveling the world, you realize that different groups adjusted to completely different diets. And they thrived on them. So different people need different diets.
That's so interesting. So what is the scientific rationale for prescribing different doses and forms of nutrients for different patients?
Well, we use diet and supplements differently, again, than a lot of practitioners, alternative and conventional. Everything we do is geared toward bringing the autonomic nervous system into balance. Now, without wishing to get too technical, I'll give the one-minute version of the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system was named by Langley in 1898, and autonomic is just a play on the word automatic. And basically, this is the unconscious nervous system that controls all physiological processes like respiration, cardiovascular function, digestion, endocrine function, immune function, that doesn't require conscious input. And it's divided into two branches, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and the details aren't important. But we believe that disease occurs when the autonomic nervous system is out of balance. After all, that controls all physiological and biochemical processes in the body. It's the ultimate regulator of metabolism in the body. And when that's out of balance, you end up with serious problems. Now, it's not just, again, our idea. Francis Pottinger Sr. wrote a brilliant book, 1944, we discussed the autonomic nervous system and its basis in imbalance as the basis of human disease. And Ernst Gellhorn, who was a professor at the University of Minnesota, had published 400 papers and 8 textbooks on the autonomic imbalance as the basis of disease. And what we're trying to do with diet and supplements is bring an out-of-balance autonomic system into balance. For example, if a patient comes in with a strong sympathetic nervous system, they need to be on a plant-based diet, and they need to be on certain supplements like beta-carotene, the B vitamins, the thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, pyridox, and folic acid. They don't do well with B12, choline, inositol, PAVA, pantothenic acid. They do well with high doses of C. They do well with high doses of D. They do not do well with high doses of B. They do terribly with calcium, but great with magnesium. Forget the 2-to-1 calcium to magnesium ratio. With our sympathetic dominant patients, where we're trying to tone down their strong sympathetic system, we'll put them on 1,000, 1,200 milligrams of magnesium, maybe 150 milligrams of calcium. It's like an 8-to-1 ratio of magnesium to calcium. They do well with certain trace minerals, manganese, chromium, but not zinc and selenium. They do well with the plant-based essential fats from flaxseed or other nut and seed oils, like flaxseed, hemp oil. They do well with those. They don't do well with fish oil. Other patients come into us have a strong parasympathetic nervous system and a weak sympathetic system, and these are the patients that will thrive on a meat diet. These are the kind of patients that would go to Atkins and thrive. They need lots of fatty red meat. They really do well with it. That helps bring the strong parasympathetic system down a bit and builds up their weak sympathetic system. Fatty red meat has certain nutrients in it that have a very strong effect on the autonomic nervous system. For example, fatty meat is loaded with sulfates and phosphates that in the body are converted into free acid. And what that does is it tones down the sympathetic system. Also, fatty meat has lots of phenylalanine and tyrosine, which are the precursors of the sympathetic neurotransmitters, norepinephrine and epinephrine. So when you give somebody red meat, you're turning on their sympathetic system, turning down their parasympathetic system. Fatty meat has lots of saturated fat, which was demonized for the last 50 years. Fortunately, that's starting to change. Whatever saturated fat may do, it's a strong sympathetic stimulant. So someone who has a strong parasympathetic system, weak sympathetic system, you're trying to bring it into balance, red meat with lots of saturated fat is absolutely perfect for them. Those patients do well with a whole other set of nutrients. They don't do well with thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, pyridox, and folic acid, but do well with B12, pantothenic acid, choline, inositol, PAVA. They don't do well with high doses of C. These are the people that take high doses of C and feel sick. They don't do well with high doses of D. Sorry, Dr. Cannell, thinks everyone should be on high doses of D. They don't, but they thrive on E. They thrive on calcium. Our strong parasympathetic dominants, who often get the blood-borne tumors like leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, and sarcomas, which are connective tissue tumors, they'll do well with 2,500 milligrams of calcium and maybe 100 milligrams of magnesium. They do terribly with magnesium. Magnesium makes them depressed, and they read all this literature about the value of magnesium, go on it, and they go into depression for 3 days and can't figure out why. They think that they're morally weak because they can't tolerate magnesium, but it's just their innate metabolism. They need huge amounts of calcium 10, 15 times as much calcium as magnesium. They don't do well with manganese and chromium, but do well with zinc and selenium. They do really well with the polyunsaturated fats from fish oil. These are the patients that actually can tolerate fish oil, don't do as well with flaxseed oil, hemp oil, chia seeds. They don't do as well with those fatty acid sources. They need the animal-based, not the plant-based sources of essential fatty acids. And they'll thrive on a completely different diet and a completely different set of supplements than what we call our sympathetic dominant patient. Then we have balanced people who have a equally strong sympathetic and parasympathetic system, but they may be functioning at an inefficient level. They're both genetically determined to be equally strong, but they're not working too efficiently. And they need all kinds of vitamins. First, in terms of diet, they do well with plant foods. These are the people that do well on a Mediterranean diet. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds. Yeah, they tolerate grains fine. Fish, poultry, some red meat, cheese. These balanced people do well with dairy products like, you know, of course, raw milk, whole milk, cheese. They do well with a variety of vitamins and minerals, beta-carotene, vitamin A, all the different B vitamins, moderate doses of C, moderate doses of E, moderate doses of E, all the fat-soluble vitamins, moderate doses of K. They do well with moderate doses of calcium, magnesium, potassium, manganese, chromium, zinc, and selenium. They do well with both plant-based sources of essential fats as well as the fish-based and animal-based sources of essential fats. So they need a variety of nutrients at moderate doses. So every diet and every supplement program has to be really carefully thought out, because every food, every amino acid, fatty acid, every component of food, things like the sulfates, phosphates, the vitamins, minerals, trace elements, whatever else they may do as antioxidants, they all have a very profound effect on the autonomic nervous system. And if you discount that or don't consider that, you can end up creating metabolic chaos in your patients.
That's so interesting that you say that. So what are some of the things that you look for as you're doing your intake? What are some of the tests that you do to determine the sympathetic or parasympathetic?
How efficient they are, how inefficient they are. But there are also clinical signs, and a good clinician can pick this up right away. There's no magic to it or some secret that only I have. You know, I've been doing this for 27 years. A patient can walk into my office. I don't even need the blood work or the hair, because I can pretty much assess them based on my experience. You know, experience is a great thing as a clinician. I've been doing long enough to get that kind of experience. For example, patients that get the typical solid tumors, like tumors of the breast, lung, stomach, pancreas, colon, liver, uterus, ovary, prostate, always have a strong sympathetic system and a weak parasympathetic system. That's one of the reasons they get those cancers. So immediately, if someone walks in with breast cancer or colon, you know they need to be on a plant-based diet. Patients that get the traditional blood-borne or immune cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, or sarcomas, which are genetically related to the immune cancers, they're connective tissue cancers, they need to be on meat. These are the people that will thrive on a ketogenic diet. Balanced people with a balanced autonomic system, they don't tend to get cancer, but they can get chronic fatigue and allergies and those kind of things. And again, if they're a non-cancer patient, you can pretty much pick up whether they're balanced or not based on their needs. Psychology tells you a lot. Sympathetic dominance, as we call them, tend to be very aggressive. That what would be called a type A. They make good business leaders, good trial lawyers. They like to argue. They like to regulate everyone else's life, make rules for everyone else. Parasympathetics are very creative. They don't do well in school. They don't do well with authority. They don't do well with regimented situations. They don't do well in office situations. They do best if they're left to their own and be very creative. You know, like Ernest Hemingway is the classic parasympathetic dominant. Never even went to college and was a mediocre high school student. Ends up winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. Very undisciplined, but very creative. So parasympathetics tend to be creative. These are general rules. Balanced people, somewhere in between, they can fit in with regimentation and authority. They can also be creative at certain times. So just by a patient's personality or lifestyle or what they're doing, you kind of know where they are. If someone walks in and they're a business executive with prostate cancer, you immediately know they're a strong sympathetic dominant, and they need to be on a really, that patient like that has been a leader in his business community. You know they're extremely sympathetic dominant. They need to be on a really plant-based diet with lots of fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains, and not too much animal protein.
So, Doc, I know you've spent a lot of time in your career investigating the work of Dr. William Kelly. First of all, you know, before we get into sort of how that investigation went and the publishing of it, what were the results that you found from that studying?
Yeah, I was a second-year medical student, actually at the end of my second year, July 1981, 1,000 years ago, when I first had the opportunity to meet Kelly. And what was interesting is that he opened up his records to me, and I was a medical student at the time, but my mentor was Robert Good, who was president of Sloan Kettering. He was encouraging my research career. I went to Cornell Medical School here in New York because Good was associated with Cornell at Sloan Kettering, and I wanted to work under him. And he adopted me into his research group after my second year in medical school. And when I met Kelly, I went to Dr. Good, and I said, you know, here's this guy who claims he has this reversing cancer with this complicated system where he's manipulating the autonomic nervous system using enzymes and coffeinomics. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. But Good said you should start looking into him. I had a grant for the summer. So I went down to Dallas, Texas, where Kelly was based, and started going through his records. And from day one, even though, you know, I had 2 years of medical school, which isn't a huge amount, but I knew enough to see that these were remarkable cancer patients. He had patients with pancreatic cancer, metastatic colon cancer, metastatic breast into the bone, were alive 5 and 10 years, 15 years later, clearly just having been treated by him after failing standard therapy. And after 2 or 3 weeks, I gathered together dozens of these cases, brought them back to Dr. Good, who said, these are remarkable cases. We spent hours together going over them. And he encouraged me to begin a formal research investigation of Kelly that I finished when I was a fellow under his group. By that point, he'd been pushed out of Sloan Kettering, and I followed him ultimately down to Old Children's Hospital in Florida, where he set up a bone marrow transplant unit. And I went through over 1,000 of Kelly's records, interviewed 455 of his patients. And I still follow some of his patients today. There was a woman who was diagnosed with metastatic pancreatic cancer in 1982. It was actually August 1982. She went to surgery. They thought she had gallbladder disease. Opened her up, and she had a tumor in the pancreas, tumor in the liver. They biopsied the liver tumor, and it turned out to be adenocarcinoma, which is the most aggressive form of pancreatic cancer. Closed her up. This was in Appleton, Wisconsin, where she lived. She decided to go to the Mayo Clinic, where they reviewed the slides, confirmed the diagnosis, and decided that chemotherapy would be useless, and told her that she should just get her affairs into order. She had heard about Kelly through the word of mouth grapevine in the health food stores, came under his care, and 33 years later, she's in August, it'll be 33 years, she's alive and well. She's never gone back to have CAT scan, so I don't know if the tumors are gone. But here's a patient with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, biopsy-proven liver metastases, confirmed in a major academic institution, i.e. the Mayo Clinic, who's alive 33 years later. To put her case in perspective, I know no patient in the history of medicine, and I check the literature regularly, with stage 4 biopsy-proven liver metastases from pancreatic adenocarcinoma is alive 33 years later. That's the kind of patient we found. And was case after case like this of terminal disease who got well under his care. I'd never seen anything like it, nor had Dr. Good, who was president of Sloan Kettering and the most published author in the history of medicine, etc. He admitted he would never say this publicly because investigating someone like Kelly is a controversial thing and it's a career risk for someone in that position in the academic medical world. But he supported me for 5 years, and I eventually put my results together in a monograph form, which initially we couldn't get published because the editors couldn't believe that someone who had no academic affiliation, and Kelly was a dentist, he wasn't even supposed to be treating cancer technically, someone with no academic affiliation, no fame within the academic medical world, was producing these kind of results. So the general consensus of the editors who reviewed the monograph was it had to be fake, that I had somehow conned Dr. Good, or it wasn't real, or I'd been snookered, or he'd been snookered. The fact is they were real. In fact, we followed some of these patients in our immunology clinic back 30 years ago, and I follow some of these patients today. So they're alive and well, you know, like 33 years later. So we finally got the book published in, I think it was about 2009, called One Man Alone, where I have 50 case reports of patients treated by Kelly with appropriately diagnosed, biopsy-proven, terminal or very poor prognosis cancer, alive 5, 10, 15 years later, in most cases with obvious radiographic evidence of regression of disease. So it would meet all the criteria. There's biopsy-proven, confirmed regression of disease on scans in most cases, and certainly long survival. And many of these patients were diagnosed in major institutions like the Mayo Clinic, Sloan Kettering, Stanford, Dana-Farber, and Harvard. So it took us a while to get it out, but finally 2009 we decided to finally get it published. I updated, rewrote it, and it's out there. So the results were extraordinary. There was another patient that just really extraordinary. She was diagnosed in 1969 with uterine cancer. It was so big at that time that they couldn't do surgery, so they decided to do radiation first. Then the tumor shrunk, so they did a hysterectomy, and they told her she was cured. She went on hormone therapy for a while, which was an experimental thing, didn't work. Then she went to see Kelly. Well, she died at age 95 years old in 2009, 40 years after she was diagnosed, and 34 years after she was diagnosed with stage 4 disease. To put her in perspective, I know no patient in the history of medicine, and I checked the literature, alive 34 years later with proven biopsy-documented metastatic stage 4 endometrial cancer, and the original diagnosis goes back to 1969. So when she died in 2009 at 95 years old from old age, quietly in her sleep, and I kept in touch with her all the decades after I interviewed her for my study. She was in superb health, and lived to be 95. So she was another example of it. These were not just unusual patients. These are extraordinary patients. We have patients like that.
That's amazing. So, you know, your work on Dr. Kelly and the review, where has that gone in terms of the academic literature? Why don't more people know about this?
I guess ignorance is his own best defense. They figure if they ignore me, maybe I'll die suddenly or get hit by a truck on Park Avenue and they won't have to worry about me. Certainly a lot of academicians know about me because, you know, I wasn't living in a cave or working in a cave. My mentor was the most published author in the history of medicine and president of Sloan Kettering for 10 years. I went to Cornell to work under him. You know, I lived in his house when I joined his group as a fellow. He was more than just, you know, some vague teacher. He really mentored me. I used to spend Christmas with him and his family. That's how close we were. Didn't matter. I mean, after it got known in the academic world that I was getting these unusual results, he started getting letters from colleagues, and he knew, you know, I met Nobel Prize winners, so he knew a lot of people. They would say, Dr. Good, Robert, and he would show me these letters, you're risking your career. He'd been nominated for the Nobel Prize 3 times, and you can only be nominated 3 times. He was up for the 3rd time back in the 80s, and he was being warned that your involvement with this kind of quackery and craziness is going to jeopardize your chance of winning the Nobel Prize. So academicians at the highest level of the academic medical world, far from being the open-minded scientists that we would like to believe, you know, in the TV movies that they are, turned out to be just, you know, kind of closed-minded, bigoted. And it was kind of a learning experience for me because I had approached this with such great innocence that isn't this wonderful? Here's this guy doing this non-toxic, relatively inexpensive treatment for terrible cancer for which there are no other academic treatments or conventional treatments that work. We should all be celebrating. Far from that, it was like just condemnation, and Dr. Good was warned to back off or he's going to jeopardize his chance to win the Nobel Prize, which he ultimately didn't win anyway. There is a book by Dr. James Turner, now deceased, brilliant MD, PhD out of Tulane, who got interested in alternative medicine. He wrote a book called Racketeering in Medicine, a very subtle title. In the introduction, he talks about the fact that he believes one of the reasons Dr. Good was pushed out of Sloan Kettering is because he supported people like me. One of the things about Dr. Good, he had an extremely open mind, and here's a guy, President Sloan, supporting a medical student looking into a notorious alternative practitioner back in 1981, before it was acceptable to talk about cancer nutrition in the same sentence. But he had the guts to do that, but he took a lot of criticism. And Turner, who knew Good quite well, absolutely believes that one of the reasons the board of directors at Sloan pushed him out was because he was supporting people like me. I mean, Turner has my name right in the introduction discussing that. So it was extraordinary to me, thinking that scientists are supposed to be these unbiased, unprejudiced seekers of the truth, to learn that it was quite the contrary, that there were really a lot of them just bigoted, prejudiced guys who only believed in what they believed in and didn't want to hear that somebody else was smarter than they were, that somebody, Kelly, who was doing coffee enemas, knew how to cure cancer, when they, sophisticated professors at academic institutions, couldn't do the same. A lot of jealousy and envy, and just that's what drives medicine, not search for the truth. Of course, we see that with the vaccination issue, where it's a lot of it's ego and money and power. It's nothing to do with science or helping patients. The last thing that's important.
Absolutely. So, I mean, how do you compare, you know, I know your practice is not all cancer, but is largely still cancer patients. How do you compare the results that you see in your own practice with what conventional oncologists can do?
A good percentage of our patients, if not most of them, are actually conventional failures. They come after having failed standard chemo, radiation, et cetera, surgery, and our practice is filled with patients like that who get well. So I don't think, if you looked at it honestly and objectively, there's no comparison. In fact, if there was a comparison, if what we did wasn't any better than conventional medicine, I promise you I'd be doing something else. It isn't worth it to take the political heat from my academic colleagues, you know, the scorn of my colleagues. You know, I turned down 2 positions at Sloan Kettering, but one of the requirements, my professors thought I had a promise as an academic researcher, and they offered me twice the position, which was very gracious enough. But I would have to give up my Kelly, crazy Kelly research. This is after I left Dr. Gisbrew, finished my fellowship. I would have to give up my Kelly research. There's no way. So, you know, you really, it's a tough road to walk, for sure. But the results, the only reason you do it, you'd have to be insane not to do it for one reason only. The one reason has to be because the results are better than what anyone else is getting. And I'm trained enough as an academic scientist to know what good results are and what aren't. You know, we have patients with pancreatic cancer who has 15 plus years. We have patients with stage 4 breast cancer, which, you know, I guess the form I presented, a pancreatic cancer patient, who've been with us 25 years since I opened practice. I have a woman with stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer, the most aggressive form of breast cancer there is, had it into the bone, developed bony metastases while getting aggressive chemotherapy in 1987. She came to me in December 3rd, 1987, just after I had opened up my practice. She's alive and well today, you know, 27 and a half years later. All her disease went away just on our therapy. So when you see results like that, that the conventional physicians, I say this sadly, I wish they had great results too, but that conventional physicians can't match. In fact, they failed with this patient and she got well in our care. That's the under our care. That's the only reason you've been doing this, because the results are better than what other people are getting.
So let's talk about practicalities for practitioners that are listening to this and are engaged with the Evolution of Medicine Summit. They want to be able to replicate some part of your work. What are the sort of the leverage points for them to be able to do diet and nutrition in a way that is successful and effective and individualized? You know, also with an eye to the fact that, you know, that is there's some scale to it as well, and that this can be replicated and not replicated on such a micro scale that everyone needs tons of time. What advice would you give to providers at every level who are looking to do this kind of work with people? What really works?
The first thing I would tell practitioners is get rid of your preconceived notions of what the truth should be. This applies to conventional doctors, of course, but also to alternative doctors who will get caught up into everyone should be on Pritikin's diet, everyone should be on the ketogenic diet, and everyone should be on the Mediterranean diet. Get rid of those biases that everyone should be on one type of nutritional program, one type of diet, one type of supplement. Get rid of that, because the whole purpose of what we do is different people. Everybody that walks into your office is an adventurer. Everyone that walks into your office is different than the previous 100 people that walked into your office. And they may need a completely different diet than the previous 100 patients. You have to listen to them. And very often, what we do isn't that esoteric. It's just common sense. If you listen to the patient, they'll tell you what they need. I can't tell you how many dozens of patients we have treated who come into my office, having been seen by half a dozen conventional, half a dozen alternative doctors, and they, because this has been the prejudice over the last 30 years, they should be on a vegetarian diet, and they're doing a perfectly organic vegetarian, and they're doing terribly, and I've had patient after patient develop leukemia on a vegetarian diet. Well, it turned out they're meat eaters. It's the worst diet for them. They need to be on fatty red meat. And these patients will actually tell you that they get tears in their eyes because they, I dream about pot roast. I dream about bacon. I think I'm just morally weak. Because Pritikin and Orner say, you know, this is what people need, morally, spiritually, and physically. And they hate that diet. They don't feel well. And they end up getting sicker, which is why they come to see me. And it turns out they need to be on meat. So if you listen to your patient, if someone's on a vegetarian diet and tells you they feel terrible, don't assume they're morally weak and that they just, you know, there's some weakness why they don't like the diet. That's not the right diet for them. You know, a gazelle is never going to eat meat. They need to eat grass. And on the other hand, if your patient comes in that feels terrible on a meat diet, and Atkins had a lot of patients like that. I saw them in his office, and he would insist they had to just eat more fat, more meat, and they get sicker and sicker. They need to be on a plant-based diet, and they will tell you, I hate red meat. I had a patient in yesterday who's been with me 18 years with breast cancer, doing beautifully. Which we were kind of laughing. She said, you know, you had me typed perfectly when I first came in 1996. And I kind of said, well, what do you mean? She said, I love citrus fruit. I love fruit. I eat huge amounts of fruit. I felt ever since you put me on fruit 18 years ago, I've thrived. I feel great. And of course, cancer went away too. She hates meat. The thought of bacon makes her nauseated. In fact, she says the smell of chicken, she said this yesterday, the smell of chicken makes her nauseated. She can't stand even the smell of meat. And she thrives on fruit. She'll have grapefruit juice for breakfast and be fine into lunch. For lunch, she'll have a salad. And she does eat, you know, I've insisted she eats some eggs. And then patients like that do like dairy products. So, of course, raw milk cheese and some raw milk yogurt with minimal animal protein. And she's been with me 18 years at cancer morning and she thrives. And she will tell a practitioner what she likes. She said, I like fruit. I like vegetables. And the idea that she's going to end up with glucose intolerance and insulin resistance and all those things. Not with a patient with her metabolism, with a strong sympathetic system, they never get insulin resistance. And they eat huge amounts of fruit. And those are the patients, horrors, that can tolerate grains. And Kelly and I discussed this because she kind of went away from grains. These are patients, she's been eating grains for 18 years, got rid of her cancer, and it hasn't caused the inflammation. They thrive on it. But I have other patients that come in here, if they eat grains, they're going to get sick. They need to be on meat. So often a patient will tell you what they should be on. Like a balanced patient likes a lot of food. They'll do well at a smorgasbord. Kelly used to say your balanced patient will tell you, my greatest joy is to be at a buffet where there are all kinds of foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, fish, poultry, cheese. They like a variety of foods. They'll tell you that. So you can often tell just from a clinical history if you keep your eyes open and get rid of your preconceived notions of the truth. And then you can adjust the supplements accordingly. A lot of patients do terribly on the shotgun approach to supplements, where they're overloaded with supplements, half of them which are appropriate for them, half of them which are not appropriate, the doses can be wrong, and you can work it out. I mean, just from what I said earlier about someone who's on a plant-based diet needs B1, B2, B3, those things, someone who's on a meat diet needs B12, pantothenic acid, choline, and inositol, PABA, not a lot of C. The meat eaters are the ones that don't do well with large doses of C. They don't do well with large doses of D.